40 years ago, one film changed the world. It was the greatest disco film ever made.
Bruno Tonioli.
Saturday Night Fever was made for peanuts, but it became one of the biggest box office sensations of the decade.
It's a little disco movie. We have no budget for anything.
To me, it felt more like an art film and not a pop commercial film.
The last thing I thought of was we were going to have a movie and we'd be talking about it 40 years later.
That movie is Taxi Driver with dancing.
Bruno on an illuminated dance floor.
It was a tale of love and ambition that sparked a worldwide disco craze. It inspired a new passion for flamboyant disco dancing, and its soundtrack captured the imagination of a generation.
The album was huge right from the gate.
It gave the Bee Gees a string of number one singles.
In that moment, this was the greatest time of our lives.
It wasn't just this hit movie, it was this phenomenon, and you couldn't get away from it.
Overnight, it turned John Travolta into one of Hollywood's biggest stars.
My whole life has been a blessing with that movie. It's the foundation, it's the blueprint for my whole career. It gave me a job as a character actor. I got my first Oscar nomination.
And it broke new ground with high-octane action scenes. It was more than just a dance movie, and it had a gritty sense of reality to it. It was one of the most iconic movies of all time, but the journey from script to screen was far from straightforward. Saturday Night Fever only got made because of a series of accidents and lucky breaks.
Saturday Night Fever, the ultimate disco movie. A New York subway train rumbles across a bridge.
In 1977, I was a dancer here in New York, and I lived for the disco. Saturday Night Fever was my life and time. I thought I remembered it all, but in fact, I'd forgotten just how incredible the story was. Great performances. Even some of that dance floor action that gave us all the fever. It was a New York story made at a time when the city was crime-ridden, filthy, and almost bankrupt. Unemployment was running high. Times were hard in Manhattan, and harder still out in the boroughs. The biggest of these, Brooklyn, is just across the East River. And back then was home to Italian Americans, African Americans, and Hispanics.
Excerpts from the movie.
On Saturday night, in the neighborhood of Bay Ridge, young Brooklynites danced their troubles away in a club called 2001 Odyssey.
Really, at that time, disco was the minority's haven. And of course, in Brooklyn, it was a very predominantly Italian club, the 2001 club.
And in spring 1977, Hollywood came here to recreate this Saturday night ritual that saw kids seeking escape on the dance floor.
Outside a neon-lit venue at twilight.
4 decades later, Italian-Americans who were extras in the film remember the story like it was yesterday.
This guy, his name is Tony Maneri. He works in a hardware store.
Starts out with
the
him.
Feet, the feet, feet. He's the walking. Staying alive. Walking with his tin of paint, and then he stops at Lenny's. Right. Like, yeah, give me 2 slices.
Right.
Hey, Phil, I want that shirt. You told that shirt for me.
The mother, she's like kind of religious. And the brother, he was like a priest. The father was out of work, so he's pissed off anyway.
One pork chop.
One pork chop.
He's got a dead-end job, and he lived for Saturday night. Combed the hair and everything, and it was a thing.
Tony dances at the discotheque, and then he realizes that he wants to go other places in his life.
Annette, cigarette? Yeah. She was good.
When he saw Stephanie, he was like, oh, my God, you know what? See you later, Annette.
I changed my mind about us dancing together. I got another partner.
I don't know what he saw in her.
She's a snotty bitch, man.
And after the Spanish people danced, then they danced, and they killed it.
When he gives the prize away, he grabs a hand, he walks out, and he walks up the stairs, and he goes,
shithole!
And then everything just came to a point at the end where the friend dies and all of that. He fell off the Verrazano Bridge. White suit, he's all disheveled.
He was trying to understand what he's doing with his friends that are just hoods that got no future.
And then he says, you know what, I got to get out of here. I got to try to start my life over.
Astonishingly, the man who spotted the story potential of Brooklyn's nightlife wasn't a New Yorker at all. He wasn't even American. He was a British journalist called Nick Cohn, who was scouring New York's disco scene for material.
I started going to, first of all, to these gay clubs, and then the disco dance contests all over the five boroughs. I went to 2001 Odyssey, where the story is set, and I got the cold shoulder. Nobody would really talk to me. Outside the door, there was this guy in a body shirt and striking a pose. At that point, the light bulb went on. I'd seen this culture before with Teddy Boys and with Mods. A certain self-sufficiency. And I wrote a fictional story about what was inside his head. And that was my story of that became Saturday Night Fever.
Cohn's story appeared in New York Magazine.
He'd been a novelist since he was 19, and you could tell that by the way he described nightlife in Brooklyn, a world away from Manhattan.
A dance floor bathed in crimson light.
Three great dances featured in Saturday Night Fever, enrapturing the public and making it a box office sensation. The line dance is the first and easiest. It gave audiences something new, a piece of film action they could recreate on their own local dance floor. This is happening in London, and choreographer Carl Paris is at work with a new generation of disco dancers. He's introducing them to the routines that went down in disco history.
The dancers being shown a scene from the movie before attempting to replicate the moves.
Funny. I want to ask you, actually, how does it feel for this new generation? How does it feel doing this? It's fun, isn't it? There is no kind of trying to outdo each other. It's kind of, there is a sense of having a lot of people together, having a great fun without giving attitude.
One, two, three, four.
Bruno smiles as he watches.
To my eye, the line dance has a tinge of country and western. But it turns out it's a glimpse of a dance that was current in New York in 1977.
I never saw it in the clubs before the movie.
Well, this dance existed from the black clubs known as the Electric Slide. A line dance, basic, but kind of with giving more funk, more soul. It's a lot more earthy.
And then everybody did it.
Everybody's doing a black dance.
Exactly.
In the film, we can see how seriously Tony takes his dancing. He's like an athlete. He treats dance like sport. This attitude allowed straight white males to feel comfortable and take to the dance floor.
Has that kind of feel, hasn't it?
It makes you feel happy.
Come on, get down, sorry, kids.
Bruno with his arm round Carl's shoulders as they watch the dancers.
Nick Cohn found the Brooklyn dance story, but it was Australian music supremo Robert Stigwood who realised that it could transfer to the big screen.
Robert Stigwood is 37, a millionaire, and having fun.
I was working for Robert Stigwood. He'd made his fortune being an outlier.
He was a maverick. He didn't go by the rules. He wasn't interested in received wisdom. And he took that approach into all the businesses he was in.
Bill Oakes.
Stigwood managed pop groups, among them the Bee Gees. By the mid-70s, the supergroup were in the doldrums, reduced to playing in working men's clubs.
We did a whole stint at Batley's Variety Club and places like that in Sheffield and around during what we used to call it the pop wilderness, we were at a point where we would probably have gone back to Australia and accepted the fact that we were a five-year group.
The Bee Gees' Barry Gibb.
But Stigwood had seen how disco might salvage the Bee Gees' career.
The Bee Gees performing.
Well, he was a visionary. He was probably one of the only guys left like that who created opportunities for the artist. And he was always the kind of guy that would make you do something that maybe you'd never done before. He drew the originality out of you. You know, doing something different is always the biggest risk.
Leaving their R&B ballads behind, the Bee Gees wrote Jive Talking. It was a huge hit, and they became a major disco act. It wasn't long before they'd be singing the soundtrack for Saturday Night Fever. Meanwhile, Stigwood had his eye on another career, that of a young TV actor playing a character called Vinnie Barbarino in US sitcom Welcome Back, Cotter.
The first time I heard John's name was Robert saying he was watching Welcome Back, Cotter, and he said there's this kid in it who is great, and he said he's going to be a movie star.
It was kind of a phenomenon, at least for among young girls it was. He'd gotten a lot of attention, and Stigwood decided he wanted to sign him to a three-picture deal.
The three-picture deal for $1 million was what said to me that everything my manager and I had worked hard for since I was 16 years old had come to fruition, and that it was our job to do the best with that three-picture deal.
No one had signed a television actor to a three-picture million-dollar deal, and that was typical Robert. He did nothing by halves.
I was 17 years old, and I was auditioning for a big Broadway musical called Jesus Christ Superstar, and I gave a really good audition. And I didn't know really who Robert Stigwood was, but apparently he was in the audience taking notes on a yellow pad, work pad. And cut to, that was 1971, and then cut to 1977. And he said, now I might show you what I wrote about you. And he took the yellow pad and it read, this boy is too young for this production of Jesus Christ Superstar. However, watch out. He's going to be something. And how about that?
Stigwood had the rights to make the musical Grease for the big screen, but it was delayed.
I think Grease was running as a show. They didn't want to start the movie till later. So Robert was on the lookout for something for John to do.
One of the first projects I acquired was this magazine article called Tribal Rights of the New Saturday Night.
Right from the beginning, Robert saw this as a commercial piece with wide appeal. He read the article and he said, I want to do the movie.
The lady I was living with, she said, we got a call from a Rabbi Stigfeld. I think he was looking for contributions. I told him where to go. Bill just rang in and said, is that true? Are you available? I said, yeah, I'm totally available. So I bowled around for tea.
We were able to make a deal with him. And so we showed it to John Travolta, and this he loved it.
There's not a guarantee that a story about a slice of life in Brooklyn will turn out to be a valid film story. And to me, it felt more like an art film and not a pop commercial film. It turned into that, but I'm not sure whether we expected that.
Stigwood had a star, the Bee Gees for the soundtrack and the story, but no cash for a big Hollywood production team. Overnight, his assistant, Kevin McCormick, became a film producer.
The ramp up to this becoming a movie was both quick and unguided, and I'm on the front lines of this with literally no experience and no supervision. So I went out to California and I went to various agencies and said, well, I was looking for a director and I have this magazine article, and basically got a sort of cold shoulder from everybody, and there was one particular director that I was kind of interested in.
John Avildsen had just made another Italian-American story on a tiny budget. It hadn't been released yet, but everyone said he was a director to watch.
The phone rang, and it was this Marvin Moss, and he said, you know what, kid, you're in luck. He read the article, and he's interested, but you better see his new movie first. So we went to see Rocky before it opened.
Filming a scene in the movie.
And John Avildsen became the first director of Saturday Night Fever.
Avildsen wanted screenwriter Norman Wexler to work on the Nick Cohn story. It was another gamble.
He was manic depressive. He seemed extremely subdued, and he chain smoked a lot. and was very low-key and very slow to speak.
He made it his duty to really do research in Brooklyn and Manhattan.
He would stay up all night and write.
He would haunt those clubs in his old raincoat and a little scratch pad making notes.
Norman Webster's an excellent writer. He captured the grittiness and the length. It's probably, beyond a shadow of a doubt, the most rough-language movie in movie history. And without repeating the lines, I could tell you because we used them so effortlessly and as punctuations for sentences or operative words that it didn't offend. It was just natural communication.
My Vincent is a quite two-dimensional character. He was able to put much more flesh on the bone.
He was written no differently than a De Niro character in Taxi Driver or James Caan in The Godfather. He was gritty, sensitive, rough, but stylish. His instinct for dance and dressing was of another level. But at the same time, he was a Brooklyn tough kid. But he had hopes and dreams that went beyond the obvious. And that's what made him so special.
We'd all read the first draft, and as long as it was, there was real cinematic gold in it.
That movie is Taxi Driver with dancing. It's a rough, tough movie. People should be offended by every thing we do in that movie.
Come on, fuckhead! Hey, stubborn fuck won't budge!
Wexler's dialogue was harsh. John Avildsen began to worry about it. He also began worrying about other aspects of the film, the music. But Stigwood had no fears about the soundtrack. He and his record exec, Bill Oakes, headed to France to discuss the film with the Bee Gees.
Robert called me up. He just said, would you write a few songs for this film? And it just went from there because we were really mixing a live album, you know, in Herriville at the Chateau. And they came to see us, Bill Oakes, Robert.
They were in a studio mixing stuff and we told them about the movie. I said, do you want to see a script? They said, nah.
We never read the script. All we needed to know was, what's the subject matter? Did I have any titles? That's what he said. You know, and I said, yeah, I got some titles. I liked Night Fever and How Deep Is Your Love and Stayin' Alive. And Robert liked all the titles, but there were no songs at that point.
A few days later, this cassette arrived, magically, with 5 number ones on it. I mean, it was extraordinary.
We were in a very, very old building. We sit on the stairs because the echo was great. Truthfully, songs were written in a day or two. It usually happened quick.
I can't recall a time when someone had written so many obviously smash hits in such a short time.
Back in New York, director Avildsen was now worrying about the dancing in the film. He realized Travolta was going to have to deliver something exceptional. Dancer Danny Terrio was hired to build his athleticism and take his performance to another level. Travolta, already a natural, thought it would be easy.
He goes, I already know how to dance. I turned the radio on, Jungle Boogie, Cool in the Gang.
Yeah.
And he started dancing, and I watched him. I said, that's very good, John. Now sit down. And I put the music back on, yeah. And I started doing the Russian leaps, the splits, yeah, and the knee drops. And
yeah.
He went, I've got to learn that. Now, I would show him a move, and it wouldn't look good on him.
So you have to make it good for him.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
yes.
We used to do up. Yeah. And if you notice, if you watch John.
Yeah, that's the point. That's a classic.
Yeah, yeah.
The point.
The point.
The point. I mean, that is just like forever. You go from the kind of classic disco, like, you know, that the hand movement.
Yes. The knee drops.
I call it the knee cracker. Oh, that's hard.
Yeah, one arm comes out, and then you cross over like this, and then you start. Down and up, down and up. And then the other one was when he did the clock split. Where he'd split like this. And come over
down.
And split?
Yeah,
that was to the clock.
Every day, 5, sometimes 6 days a week, from about 7 in the evening till 10 after Cotter was overtrained. It's not that I'm limited as a dancer. I'm an actor who loves to act, but I'm also an actor who loves to dance. The dance I learned for Saturday Night Fever took months to train and drill. A real dancer could learn that in a couple of weeks.
Denny gave John Travolta brilliant moves for a solo dance. The producers were invited to preview steps that would go down in dance history.
John comes up to me, goes, Robert's coming tonight to the studio. Robert comes in with Kevin McCormick, and they all sat down. John goes, let's go. So here we are, the two of us.
We're together, we're doing this together,
and we're doing the point, you know, and oh yeah, but it was so much fun.
Carl's dancers watching the movie.
In London, Carl Paris walks his young troupe through the sequence.
Love that. Into above the head. And then you're doing the roll.
Some are already professionals who know how hard it is. They understand what Denny put Travolta through for a career-defining performance. For these kids, dance is life and work. Of course, they've spotted the very dangerous maneuver at the heart of this dance, and it's a reminder of the genuine risks Travolta took for his first big film.
The knee cracker and those incredible slides into the rolls, I will never ask you to do because he had months to get it right, and you know, and you got your life's ahead of you. I'm not gonna. You put your leg in the wrong place, you're gonna twist your knee, and you're out.
Modern day Brooklyn.
If Travolta had been injured, filming would have been delayed. Time was money, and there wasn't any. Scenes had to be shot in real Bay Ridge locations to save cash. Tony Manero's family home was found on 79th Street. Kevin McCormick's career began in this house.
Kevin steps inside.
He hasn't been back in 40 years.
Where you been?
Mother wants to know where you've been.
I don't remember wood floors, but they look great. And it's a lot brighter and bigger than it seemed.
Your father's asking you where you've been.
Famous dinner table scene took place around here. It's full of people and equipment and cable. You were kind of cowering over in corners, holding your breath so that you didn't disrupt the shot.
Upstairs is the bedroom Tony shares when his brother suddenly leaves the priesthood.
I'm leaving the priesthood.
I think it was sort of darker.
You got fired, huh? I didn't get fired, I quit.
Rather than it being a tragedy for Tony, it's a completely liberating experience. Because if his brother's not that good, then he doesn't have to be that bad.
The task of finding the house and all the other locations fell to Lloyd Kaufman. He was a stranger to Bay Ridge and remembers it well, all things considered.
40 years. Our company, Troma, put together all those locations in Rocky. So Avelson brought me on to make sure that we could get the locations for nothing. You know, it was a low-budget movie. So I don't think we paid more than $100 a day for anything. I had never been to Brooklyn. This thing was a nightmare for me. I knew nothing.
What do you mean you knew nothing? How did you find all these places without knowing anything?
There was no GPS. There was no MapQuest. The only thing I had was my partner's mother-in-law. She gave me some driving directions. It was hell. I hated it. It was horrible. I hated the job. John Avelson, I was there for him because I knew he would make a great movie.
Yeah. We are approaching 86th Street.
Yes.
Key location, the famous walk.
Yes. Which was done with a skateboard, I think.
Oh, look! Lenny's Pizza.
Yeah.
Here we are. The original.
A framed picture of John Travolta on the wall.
Well, Bruno, here we are.
We are recreating history. Was it his sister that actually served him the double whammy pizza sandwich?
Three, Tony, two or three.
Two, give me two, let's go.
Give me two. That way. We don't have John's sister, so
no.
We have to make do. Oh, there you are.
You hold the one.
So we do that.
I think it wasn't, I think it's like that, right?
Yeah. Oh, like that he did
it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good, huh?
Whatever we make it here is 100%.
Eating a double-sliced pizza like Tony orders in the film.
It was delicious.
Yeah, it's good pizza. It's
good. Oh, my God. The way John had it.
Yep.
Bruno and Lloyd climb into a yellow cab.
Finding the buildings was only the beginning of Lloyd's problems.
The DP wants lights on the roof next door, and then he wants lights in the windows across the street, and then you have to get the streets wetted down. We had to have bathrooms outside, and all that stuff I had to provide for nothing, basically. I had to, you know, there was no money for that. It was a constant stress. It was not fun.
It would cost millions.
It was amazing.
Oh, is the hardware store?
Is it still here? I don't even know. Is this it?
Oh, Lloyd, this is it.
But it's still a hardware store.
Yeah, it looks like it's, well, it's now a home center.
The shop today and in the film.
But how did you convince them to let you have the
shop? I think they were really nice. I think they just let us do it. I don't even think they charged us. It went very well. The people who ran the store were lovely.
Was it his sister or his mother that played one of the clients?
His mother was buying the paint.
Buying the paint.
Yeah. I had to get a place for John Travolta to stay because we didn't have the big honey wagons. The bathroom couldn't be on location because, you know, it makes noise, flushing the toilet. If one toilet gets stopped up, and you've got a 200-man crew,
you're done.
Your whole production is constipated.
But then, just weeks from the start of shooting, John Avildsen, now loaded director of Rocky, began to lose faith in the film.
The more successful he got, the more doubt he had about Saturday Night Fever. He couldn't figure out who the choreographer was. Should it be like ballet? Should it be like this? Should it be like that? In the end, he really never could quite figure out exactly what it should be.
And John, bless him, but changed the script to Mickey O'Neill, an Irish boy who was a good deeder on the streets of Brooklyn. And he did favors for old ladies, and he wanted to show his generosity to all, which is a fine idea, but it wasn't anything what I agreed to. So I went to Robert Siegert and I said, Robert, this is another movie, man. I said, this isn't the movie I signed up for.
Stigwood calls from London and says, well, what's going on? And I said, well, you know, John Avildsen's been thinking, and he thinks the Bee Gees are over, so he wants to get rid of the Bee Gee music. He said, really? I said, yeah. And he said, well, tell him to be at my apartment tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. The two of us show up at the appointed hour a little bit early, and Stigwood comes in and he goes, listen, John, I have good news for you and bad news for you. The good news is I just took a call. You've just been nominated for an Academy Award, and the bad news is you're fired.
The production was suddenly rudderless. Newbie producer Kevin McCormick was facing a disaster. He didn't even have his leading lady yet.
We didn't have Stephanie yet. We had seen a bunch of the faces they weren't committed to yet. This house was picked. A lot of the key things were already sort of settled on. But the schedule and the shape of the script and what we were going to shoot was not. Now what do? You get another director and you go because you have the slot with Travolta. And if you don't get him, somebody else does. But I was shit scared, I'll say that. I come out to California. I go back to a bunch of different people's offices. There's one particular guy, John Badham, who I'd met.
And John Badham had directed a baseball film. Forget the title. I thought, well, he knows how to put a picture together, but he's from Texas. How the hell will he duplicate, understand Brooklyn? I don't know. It's going to be a real task here.
I got to his agent. I said, listen, if he wants to do it, I'll fly him to New York. He's got to meet with me and Stigwood. He's got to meet with Travolta.
John Badham.
I got on a plane and went to New York. And as I'm on the plane, I'm reading this very long script. I was going, oh my God, this is a great movie. And as I'm reading it, I go, this is a bloody musical. What's the music going to be? What's the dance going to be like? Oh my God, and we're starting in 2.5 weeks.
He comes into New York and we have this meeting, and it's decided to go with Badham.
Although the film didn't even have a complete cast, John Avildsen had, however, done some auditioning.
I think I had 3 auditions with John Avildsen.
John Avildsen had a Super 8 camera, and my screen test was with Ray Liotta and David Caruso with John Travolta. And eventually I got put on hold for the movie.
It went away for a while, so I just assumed I didn't get it, it didn't happen.
Now Badham continued the auditioning process.
And we went casting. And through his casting process, I realized he was more of a filmmaker than I had anticipated. He was tastier than I thought and more interesting than I thought. And who he liked, I liked.
They were put out a casting call for guys that were relatively big in size. I didn't really look like I was from Brooklyn. So I showed up for this audition thinking I had nothing to lose. And I just sort of went for it.
I thought all along this was a nothing part. When it came back again and John Badham was directing, I thought, hey, why are they bringing me back in for 5-6 lines? And then the call came in and I was thrilled.
I was brought in to read for a new director, John Badham, and I ended up getting the part. I came through the two directors and got the part.
And then the script came, and I nearly had a heart attack.
It wasn't a bit part, it was the second biggest female role, Annette. Badham, meanwhile, still needed to find his lead female character, Stephanie. She came by chance and by taxi.
We took a taxi down to see A Star Is Born, and in it was the nephew of Stigwood. And he said he's making this movie, and I said, am I in it?
She hadn't even been put up for the job.
And she probably went and hassled her agent.
I said, submit me for this part or I'll kill you.
She was like not even on the short list. She basically pushed her way into being seen.
When Karen came in, she had it. She just could right away do it.
And she ends up with the job.
Badham had his cast and just days to turn them into characters.
John Badham is an actor's director. And he believes in rehearsal. He believes in promoting a closeness with the cast so they feel very comfortable once you're on camera.
Filmmakers were doing that at the time. Scorsese was doing that. Brian De Palma was doing that at the time. These filmmakers wanted authenticity. There's less work to do if there's a chemistry that's organic than to try to create a chemistry on screen.
A black and white still.
The whole idea was that we would do everything we could together as a gang, play basketball. That's when we started to create that bond.
We'd all go to lunch as these characters.
We went out to restaurants together, pizza joints, and we just, you know, basically improvised.
And they were just god-awful to me. They would order pizza and fridge and leave me out.
That's the only way the movie would work, is if we believed that we grew up together in the neighborhood.
By the time we hit the set, I would say we were a family of sorts.
The Badham Bunch finally looked like they've grown up together. But what about dancing together? Badham now drafted in another choreographer to make his actors into disco fanatics.
He brought in this choreographer who's this hilarious guy, Lester Wilson. He was a wonderful, juicy guy that brightened up the movie. He'd show up and everybody had to get into it and you had to learn how to do it, right?
And we worked for a long time on the way the look of the dancing would be, you know, the style of the dancing.
He had a feel for that. He had the rhythms. He had the moves.
I wanted a choreographer who was going to treat all of our dances like ones that the kids had learned themselves, learned from each other.
What Lester brought in was very practical, this is what kids do, authentic, basic dance moves.
They wanted the feeling that everyone in that club was like this, that we did this all the time, that we came together because of the dancing. We knew, you knew the step.
I felt very clumsy at first because a lot of the dance that I did with John had spins and this and moves I had never really seen. For me, it was very new territory. But John Travolta is such an amazing dancer and Lester was such a great choreographer that you had this wonderful safety net.
For the first 9 months of training, it was just with Denny. But by the time it came to the movie, we needed someone that might have had more experience at film and Broadway, so we hired Lester. And Lester basically did something very smart. He said, show me what you got. Show me what Denny taught you. And I showed him my whole portfolio of dance. And he said, okay, we're going to use all of it, but I'm just going to have to find the glue that puts these kinds of street steps together in a way that we can film. And he did. He did it beautifully. That solo was 70% Denny Terrio and 30% Lester but Lester put it together so it looked like a performance.
Lester put the soul in the picture and allowed John Travolta to find the soul that's in Tony Manero. And I think he meshed it well with the music.
By the time I first saw John dancing, it was like a miracle. It was like, this guy's wonderful.
A photo of John performing up close to the camera.
And they said, he's worked really hard to get this good.
It's unbelievable, you know, and it's so physical and he's so strong. I was blown away by how professional he was, how good he was.
You watch that now, you look at the dancing, you look at how magnificent Travolta, he's incandescent.
The classic pointing move on the dance floor.
Lester Wilson shaped all the dances, except the most famous one of all.
Do you know the tango hustle?
One day, for one crucial scene we have in the movie, was no Lester. And I speak to his dance captain, and she said, Lester took a fashion show today. And you go, no.
There would be moments when you couldn't find him. He had a beautiful assistant that was usually covering up for him when he had another job, which nobody knew about.
She said, I'll work something out. And she and John played around and came up with this tango hustle.
The tango hustle came from my inspiration from The Last Tango in Paris, which is a Brando film. And it was the first time I really saw tango on film.
And it worked just great. So we felt like we always had a backup if Lester were to take another fashion show.
Invented in an emergency, the tango hustle wins the Odyssey Dance Contest for Tony and Stephanie.
And eight, turn one, two, three,
Carl's
four,
Dance Studio.
Five, and six, seven,
in Hackney, the company have watched the dance that looks simple but is anything but. The unusual stepping pattern and the flamboyant head flicks made it difficult for Karen Lingoni.
I don't know how we danced that. That is really hard. You had to take a step, then kick.
Take that ball.
In the middle of the beat, step, kick, and you are balancing on one leg doing this kick in the air.
One, two, so the kick is on one, two.
Yeah, but my leg just can't get there.
Five, six, seven, eight.
And you had to do it in sync with your partner. That was not easy.
What's difficult is that their phrasing is really strange.
We were weaving within the beat that was set up, and we weren't always stepping on the downbeat.
One, two, three, and four. Walk five, six, kick seven, back eight.
That particular dance is not easy. Let them find that out.
And one and two, move three, four, seven, eight.
It's not really a proper
no,
tango.
It's not,
you know what I mean?
Tango.
It's kind of what you thought in Brooklyn a tango would look like.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Millions of turns, people lifting people up with their legs spread wide.
One, two, up three. Take down slowly, six, seven, and down.
Because there's such a difference in our height. He had to pull his steps, and I had to elongate my steps so that it looked like partner dancing. Very difficult.
One and two, three, four.
The dancers
five,
in couples, circling
eight,
Carl.
Two, three, four, five, and six, seven, eight, one, two. Three,
the tango hustle sequence became film legend, and so did the white suit Travolta danced in. Amazingly, it was just an off-the-peg item.
The decision was to only buy things that we could find on the rack. We wanted to give it that kind of authenticity.
Costume designer Patricia von Brandenstein had a tiny budget, just like the characters themselves.
These kids saved in increments of a quarter to buy a shirt to wear on Saturday night. It was not going to be Armani. It was going to be another kind of way of looking at it.
She had such a clear vision of what people had to look like.
They brought in things, we chose things from their wardrobes, and we added to those things.
Things just would appear that were wonderful.
Patricia, who's gone on to win many Academy Awards, found a shop in the Village in New York that we went to together. And this guy said, oh, we haven't had that kind of clothing in 3 years. But I have boxes in the back of our store that are filled with it. If you want to look at it, I said, bring it out. So he brought the mother load of disco clothes out. I mean, everything we wore in that movie came out of those boxes. It was the perfect floral shirt. It was the perfect pink pants. It was the perfect short green mint colored this and, you know, leisure suit that. And oh my gosh, it was a mother load.
John wore double pleats, a pair of high-waisted gabardine pants. He happened to have very good legs and very good bottom, and he looked great in pants, but they were tailored to his every curve.
What's up?
I like color. He looks good in strong color. He can carry it off. The other members of his gang were like mirrors of him, wannabes. They did wear the same kind of clothes, but they're softer colors because he is the king.
Petruzia was going out and finding, you know, these incredible shirts that were made of no natural fiber.
His polyesters were just coming to the fore, and that's what we wanted. We wanted that shine.
And she really brought this kind of vividness to all of the clothes. You know, they were just electric and yet affordable.
I had this polyester shirt with the light bulbs on it. In a way, I was dressed like a pimp.
Remember one thing that I ended up wearing was this peach-colored suit and a rust-colored shirt, and she just thought it was perfect, and I was horrified.
I gave them all platformed shoes. This kind of height forces a man to walk a certain way. It made you look absolutely remarkable.
To give Bobby those white platform shoes, and in that one scene when he's walking away after John borrows his car, it just, he looks so pathetic that it is just so beautifully done. That was a stroke of genius on her part. You know, the white suit was too.
A photo of John dancing in the white suit.
Originally, John wanted a black suit.
I had seen a Latin guy dance with this girl, and he looked so cool in this black suit with a white shirt. I just said to Patricia, I said, I only one request, I have to have the black suit with the white shirt because this guy looks so cool spinning her and dipping her. And I said, I just have to have that look. It was just really sexy. So can we do that? And she said, we can. But John, could I tell you my thoughts on it? And then I was started to get upset because I thought she's going to try to talk me out of this. And I want that black suit and I want that white shirt. And she said, it's a dark club. And even though you're on a colorful floor that's going to blink and do whatever, it won't show up as well. Your black suit will disappear into the night.
2 hours later, they came back with two white suits.
She created a bit of history in that one little talking me out of something.
As I've said often, heroes wear white. The famous suit was taken apart seam by seam and put back together in such a way that it absolutely fit like a glove.
Like a glove.
Finally, shooting began on March the 11th, 1977. Cast and crew knew they faced two huge problems. Very little money, hardly enough time.
We were really a low-budge kind of consciousness, which didn't match the appetite of the picture.
You have this fantasy, you're starring in a movie, right? And you're going to pick you up in a car and take you there. No. The only way we're going to get to the set is to take the subway.
My grandfather dropped me off at the location. I was making minimum per week, but it was a long enough job. This was my first film, and I didn't know you could get another take if it didn't feel good. I didn't know about much of what was going on around me.
The producers were also learning on the job. They were not ready for the problems of filming in a real community.
We opened up at 7 o'clock in the morning on 86th Street at a shirt shop. Five or six little girls start calling, hey, Barbarino, this and that. And John, he waves to them nicely. Well, within minutes, those 8 or 10 little girls became 20, and then 50, and then 100. Next thing you know, we had 1,500, 2,000 people crowded around and you couldn't get them to move.
There was 40 million people a week that watched Welcome Back, Kotter. And I was already a favorite in New York. So now you're gonna shoot outside in Brooklyn, where the character's supposed to be from?
It's a low-budget movie. We have no budget for anything. We certainly don't have a budget for security. We might have had a cop, but only because you're required to have it with your permit. It's a little disco movie. Here's this guy. He's only done a couple of things, and there's like 10,000 kids outside of the disco. From that moment on, we had to adjust our sights. This was a different kind of picture.
We could not pan the camera to the right or to the left. We couldn't even look up because people were hanging over buildings.
So we could barely get a take in. They'd say action and boom, you know, there'd be screams and, you know, I had an audience walking down the street. So if someone thought, oh, how could you be so confident walking down the street? Because I had 30,000 people going, yeah! Why wouldn't they give you confidence, you know?
A nighttime street scene.
Day one, we're in that car.
Want something? No, we ain't dropping nothing if I say so.
We shoot that opening scene, and there are 3,000 kids waiting for John. We come around this corner, and they break through whatever barricade there was and go to attack the car. I thought I was in Cuba during a revolution, I swear to God. And they're beating on the car. Barry's driving, and John yells, get out of here, and he floors it. And we're like, take off. I mean, they don't know where we are. It was exciting. It was. I remember every minute of it was crazy.
And then another kind of heavy mob started getting in on the action. The Mafia placed the whole shoot in jeopardy.
We got into some trouble in the neighborhood. We wanted to run some lights on a bowling alley across the street, and that was going to be X amount of dollars, and then there was a firebomb.
And this big old Cadillac with the tall fins came driving up in the mid-morning, and a guy who must have weighed 300 pounds came out of there and said, I hear you boys had a little barbecue here last night.
It was my first and only brush with the Mafia, which was enough for me to sort of never hope to have to do it again. We were gonna be here for the rest of the movie, and if we got shut down in any way, it would have been a catastrophe. So the stakes were very high. I had to figure out a way to pay these guys off. Like a day later, I'm in the bowling alley, and the phone rings in the payphone, and it's the district attorney. Will I wear a wire to talk to these people? And I said, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, I didn't need to be Serpico. I'm just trying to get my movie made.
What's the matter? What's going on?
It's Gus, man. He's in the hospital. The spick's got him.
For most of the cast, this was the first film. By comparison, John Travolta was a veteran. This was his second. He became a vital resource.
I don't think John ever looked at it as anything but a team effort among all of us to get us somewhere good with this movie.
He was always concerned about the overall scene and how the actor who he was working with felt. He would always say, are you okay? You happy? You want to do it again? And that made me braver.
John Travolta was the lead, the star and the glue that bound the team together. So, when a few weeks into the shoot, he suddenly left the set, everyone was stunned. In California, his partner, Diana Hyland, was dying.
When I left to do the movie, it was 6 days a week, 16-hour days. And it was all consuming. So when I got the news that it was going to happen, you know, I would talk to her often, but some days I couldn't talk to her. And when I got the news that she didn't want to tell me that it was going to happen, so my lawyer called me to say, you have to come out. And I knew when he told me that. And I just sat on the edge of my bed and sobbed. And then I got on a jet and went out and spent the last 2 days with her.
When he came back, he was a little bit more internal. He would be in his trailer a little bit more.
He went through a lot of difficulty, and he never let it hurt the film in any way. He took some time off.
He really became focused on the part.
I had this distraction of the film to get me through, but I can remember times coming into the trailer, crying in between takes and all that stuff. So I think at least for half of the movie that was on my shoulders, you know, for sure.
You know, when I watch the film, I see little teeny moments occasionally where I'll think maybe, is that
John being emotional because of what's going on in his real life, as well as what's going on for Tony.
I was such a sensitive young man, more so than because I didn't edit my sensitivities. You know, I was just raw.
Hey, looking sharp, huh? Sharp
as tough scenes lay ahead. This was the era of realism in film, and Wexler's script reflected the abuse he had seen dealt out to women.
Ain't you gonna ask me to sit down?
No, you'd do it.
But you'd ask me to lay down.
No, you would not do it.
We didn't treat Donna very well, even though we loved Donna, but we had to start getting into that mindset.
You got a stripper in the front of the club. I mean, that's really their attitude.
That women were not to be taken all that seriously, except for certain activities.
You've been in there 20 minutes. Come on.
25 in the car, 20 in the chick.
2 minutes in the car, and now it's my turn. You know, hey, like, who cares?
They were going for raw, real, authentic, so it was very visceral in that way.
It was really a sense of who they were. It was a tough movie.
The script builds the violence towards a gang rape of Annette. John Badham thought it would be too challenging for his cast and for the audiences.
It's gonna give everybody a piece of snatch
pie. Yeah.
The raping of Annette. I was worried about that scene, and I asked Robert, I said, are you sure you want to do it the way it's written here? Because I can do it much softer. And he said, no, we have to do it.
You'll fuck on, I understand.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you will.
She initiates it to get back at John, not understanding what was about to happen.
We're in a more or less like a garage, and they've got a mock-up of the back of the car.
Closed sets, as few people as possible, so you wouldn't feel as embarrassed and you wouldn't be as inhibited.
Joey, what you doing back there? Hey, you fuck, the first is always the best.
It was very hard for the boys to do that scene.
It was awkward, definitely, because we'd become friends, and you're on top of somebody who's a friend, and you're doing your first sex scene. It was very, very uncomfortable.
That's a very rough scene. I don't know if I've ever seen an American movie with that kind of crudeness in it, where basically they're gangbanging a girl with detail, with graphicness. And, you know, I remember not wanting to look at her, and John allowing me to just play it forward, because I said, if I look at her, it's too connected.
The director, the crew, everybody felt horrible. I mean, I could feel it. People looked away. They were upset because we all had a nice camaraderie.
I give Donna a lot of credit. She was brilliant in those scenes, and she was able to go with it and disassociate from it.
The rape of Annette was followed by another harrowing scene, one that actually risked the lives of the performers hundreds of feet above the Hudson River.
It's the biggest moment of scale in the entire picture. Literally, all of the drama coalesces around this single act.
We would close the bridge, create traffic jams. They hated us. They closed the upper roadway, so nobody could drive on the upper roadway from 5 o'clock on. That's during rush hour.
It was complicated, and it was freezing. And in fact, the night when we were actually going to do the stunt, it started snowing in April.
The clock was ticking, and the traffic police were fuming. Producer McCormick now pushed his exhausted team into a scene that might make his career or end it.
At first, they wanted to attach guy wires to us because we're 300 feet above the water, but it kept showing. I was an idiot. I had a lot of fool's courage. I jumped out and I said, well, let's just go for it.
I mean, literally, we're near the edge of the bridge.
Hey, Bobby!
The stuntman who did Bobby C, that guy's hanging from the wiring on the bridge.
Nowadays, if I went to do it, I would have more safety people out there than you could shake a stick at.
You would not be allowed to film on the bridge. You would not be allowed to show somebody jumping off the bridge. But we got to do all of these things.
I did it.
I was out there climbing around on the lights, 300 feet above the water, freezing cold, a lot of wind blowing.
Bob, come on. We'll talk, all right?
I didn't want to fuck up this time.
The stuntman, he jumped. This guy goes. And that was crazy, man, to see that. To see him jump off the edge of the bridge and land 50 feet down in this padded platform that they had built. Because he misses that. I mean, just forget it. The guy's in the, you know, he's in the Hudson.
After every imaginable challenge, the film was safely in the can. Now came an unimaginable technical nightmare that put its release in jeopardy.
One, two, three, good. Two, two, three, good. One, two.
The problem first surfaced in this scene. In the Finnish film, Tony and Annette dance to a piece of music specially written by composer David Shire. When it was actually filmed, they were dancing to a different song by Boz Scaggs.
That was a song that we loved. So we shoot the scene, which took us most of the afternoon. And I get a call from Kevin McCormick telling me that we cannot have the rights to Boz Scaggs' Lowdown. So I'm like that.
I remember the music getting changed several times, often after it was shot.
There were quite a few names that we'd already shot scenes to, and we had to withdraw the track, notably Boz Scaggs.
It was such a cool song, and it just at the time, and it was so beautifully popular, timelessly popular. You know, it wasn't going anywhere, that song, the Boz Scaggs song. So I wanted to use it in the movie, but we couldn't.
His manager acknowledged he'd lost out on about $5 million right there, because that's how much he'd have made from one song on the album.
Composer David Shire quickly wrote a tune that exactly matched the Lowdown beat, and in editing, it fitted perfectly.
A disco scene.
Then, the problem of a mismatch between pictures and music became much more worrying, with tracks that couldn't be replaced.
The Bee Gees music, we heard a lot of that during the filming for the first time, which was really exciting.
We could all listen to the Bee Gees music, all the rough demos on a tape deck. And it was like unbelievable to hear those songs, you know, with just them singing around piano or guitar without the full production.
I had that demo tape, and that's what we used for playback for the entire shooting of the movie.
But when the finished master tracks arrived, they were slightly slower.
When my editor, David Rollins, goes to cut the musical numbers, he finds that he can't use the good tracks. The only things that will sync up are these playback tracks, which are all kind of echoey and like this, and they sound terrible. What we would have is dancers out of sync with the music and stepping at the wrong time, and it would have been a mess.
In fact, it was a disaster. Cast and crew were gone, John Travolta was back making TV, the Odyssey scenes were unusable, and so was the new Bee Gees music.
It was an effort of several months to find some kind of technology that would get these things to sync up.
But even when the music problem was solved, a new issue arose with the way the music was mixed, one spotted by John Travolta and Barry Gibb.
I'm standing at the back of a theater with John Travolta, and we're watching this movie. The people dancing were louder than the music. And he would look at me and I would look at him. The music should be louder than the feet. You don't hear people dancing in a club. I think they're wrong. And John said, yeah, I think they're wrong too. And if you see the film now, it's the music that dominates.
There was one final problem. The star and the director couldn't agree on how the film's iconic solo dance sequence should be edited.
I worked 10 months for that. I said, and now it's all in close-ups. I said, why?
I know that Fred Astaire had in his contract that you shot him dancing, you always had to see him head to toe. And there was a good reason for that.
Too many close-ups of feet dancing might make audiences think the star had a dance double.
That's the first thing people want to assume, is that no actor could be doing that level of fighting, that level of dancing, that level of martial arts. It has to be somebody else. So there's an assumption there. I went to the editing room and I said, show me the master. That one, I did two masters, show me those. I said, okay, good. Keep it in the master.
At that point, I think we were mixing the sound on the picture. When he looked at it, I looked at David Rollins, the editor, and said, he's absolutely right. We have to do this.
Only do the close-up when I'm pointing at the audience, when I come across the audience, because I'm not dancing, I'm pointing. I said, so I don't care if you see my whole body, but other than that, keep it in the master.
He took the film from the mixing room over to his cutting room, and Worked on it for a couple of 3 hours. Didn't take too long. Brought it back, and that's what you have.
Movies is a collaborative effort, and that movie was certainly a mix of collaboration between Robert, myself, the set designers, the wardrobe designers, the dance instructors, and the director and myself. Compromises all over the place, but good ones. Ones that made sense.
With these problems resolved, next, Robert Sieg would face showing the film to the studio. It was riddled with bad language, and Stigwood anticipated trouble.
I mean, I don't give a fuck about this.
No film that I know of had ever used language as strongly.
Hey, Tom, did you fuck it yet?
The vulgarity of it was just all over the place.
Oh, you, that's pussy, man.
And of course, the minute my actors found out that they could say all of that stuff, it started to proliferate on its own.
You got nothing but three shit children now.
It wouldn't have been authentic to do it any other way.
Stupid fucking bastard.
Doesn't matter.
The script broke new ground. Certain practices were mentioned on film for the first time.
Just give me a blowjob, right?
Studio bosses Michael Eisner and Barry Diller were dismayed.
They saw the film. I knew Barry was disturbed because he would get up and walk out of the theater occasionally.
You know how many times somebody told me I was good in my life? Two fucking times.
Michael Eisner called me up afterwards and said,
"You sure as fuck never did.
We gotta get rid of a lot of this profanity.
Asshole."
Michael Eisner, I think, believed that the language was just too rough.
At the same time, Robert Stigwood is saying to me, "Do not cut a word." I'm kind of caught between a rock and a hard place here.
It's agreed by Stigwood that it'll take two swear words out of the picture. Batum takes two fucks out of the movie. Michael Eisner takes a look at it, and he starts screaming at me. Apparently, he didn't think anything had been changed at all. When I told Stigwood of my encounter, which was terrifying to me, he just started laughing.
John Badham knew that even now, the studio might refuse to release the film. Behind Stigwood's back, he desperately tried to save it.
And so I called Michael and I said, "Michael, we have cut 35% of the language." And I just was saying to myself, "I hope Robert doesn't notice that we've done this." Well, we got by with it. There was no way it was ever going to get to be a PG.
The studio accepted the new edit, but they were still worried. It was due for a Christmas release, a time for a family-friendly film.
Once he made the deal with Paramount, the next movie was going to be Grease, and Grease was going to be the $100 million film. And so we were just this little disco movie, and we were a little disco movie that's an R-rated disco movie. You know, it was too long and had some violence in it. There was no expectation.
I never detected that they were following the progress much. It was, after all, not a studio picture. Robert Stigwood had produced it, and they were distributing it. And I think you're always second in the pecking order in the studio system.
They had no idea how to put a marketing hook on this. It fell somewhere between an R-rated street picture and a musical, so what do you do with that?
Robert Stigwood now played a marketing masterstroke that he hoped would have the public loving the film even before they've seen it.
Because he controlled the record label and the music publishing, he was able to sort of, you know, make the commitment that this is, I'm going to put all the muscle I've got behind this album.
The movie soundtrack, it was released before the movie, and it went platinum.
The album was huge.
It was only when the record started flying out into the charts, we got one hit after another, that took them back, I think. Robert said, "I'm selling the record everywhere. I want it. I want the movie on everywhere."
You start here, move in. Well, whichever way you feel comfortable.
The producers dared to dream that the fans of the record might also watch the film. Could they cover the $3.5 million costs? Even before the family-friendly version came out, the film made over $85 million.
There was a line going all the way around the block for the midnight show. The 10 o'clock show had sold out.
Yeah, I was in New York, and I'd go out just to watch people stand in line, and it was crazy.
We should have a guard behind us.
One guard in front, one behind.
I saw Robert after the film had been out for about 3 or 4 days. He told me it had taken 40 million. And I took it for granted he was having me on.
This was a hit, not just you know, in New York and Brooklyn and LA and Chicago. But places like where the Campus Crusade for Christ drew 50,000 people, we were selling out.
And the theater near my neighborhood, it ran for 6 months.
It never occurred to me what was about to happen.
Cops coming up to you, hey, Joey, how's it going? You know, like it's like, what?
Aren't you? Isn't that, what, you, was that you just, you know, and it was just terrifying.
The next thing I know, I'm being sat at a couch with Bianca Jagger and Grace Jones. And, you know, 3 weeks before that, I was completely unknown.
When Robert Stigwood first read the story that became Saturday Night Fever, even he could not have seen what the movie would become. Made on a shoestring, Saturday Night Fever is believed to have made nearly $300 million since its release. But the significance of this movie isn't just its blockbuster takings.
Dancers on a Disco Floor.
It was a cultural phenomenon, one of the, you know, genuine things that defines its time.
My manager cried when he read the review in The New Yorker of the movie and my performance, because it was everything he dreamed about having for me. So I knew we had a movie with gravitas. But did I know it was a pop culture phenomenon? No.
The downside is that, you know, when I die, the obituary will be Fever Man Kicks Bucket.
I know that on my gravestone, that they're going to engrave Staying Alive. And then underneath it'll go, not.
What came out of it was sort of spun gold, actually. But I have I don't get emotional about it. I feel that smile on my face when I hear those songs. It was a good time. It was a dark time in New York, but it was out of the darkness came this movie.
Saturday Night Fever, under today's scrutiny, shouldn't succeed. You know, it's racist, it's sexist, it's full of violence, bad language, and yet there is something so compelling and so honest and so exciting about it. And at the center of it, you have this incandescent star in John Travolta. And very few times in one's life do you see somebody arrive and just take over, take hold, and be in everybody's imagination from that point on, and he certainly did it.
I'm more of an actor that says, oh, I have to dance now. I have a natural ability at it, I have a style, because I have a happiness about it, an excitement about it. It ignites people, do you know?
Bruno's wearing a white suit.
When John Travolta signed his million-dollar contract, Grease was the word. The little disco film was just a diversion. He didn't know it would make him the biggest star in Hollywood. As for the rest of us, as soon as we saw the fantastic dancing on the illuminated disco floor, we just had to get up and try the moves for ourselves. Saturday Night Fever became much bigger than the sum of its parts. An intoxicating cocktail of music, storytelling, and dance. It became one of the most significant cultural events of the 20th century. 40 years later, it's lost none of its power.
Bruno slips into step with the dancers on the disco floor.